Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for the sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire who are supporting our podcast. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any vehicle you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal, and you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Check them out at fleetuk.com.
Okay, and hello and welcome to the first Ringside Rewind with me, Tris Dixon, joined by Ian Dark and John Rawling. Gents, it's great to have you both. We've agreed that we're going to look at the life and times of Nassim Hamed today, and more specifically, your dealings with the eccentric prince. So, John, we'll kick off with you. When did Naz first appear on your radar?
Well, the first time I ever came across Naz was when I went up to Sheffield, up to Brendan Ingalls' gym, to do an interview with Harold Graham. It would be prior to one of his probably European title fights back in the 80s. And at the time, Naz was about 13 years old, and he was bouncing around on the ropes in the practice ring in there, which they've got in the gym. And Brendan was saying, you know, sort of, you're here to see Harold Graham, but look at this little fella. Look at him. He's a genius. He's going to be champion of the world. He'll be a world champion by the time he's 21. And I looked at this little kid, he was just playing around, really, not much more. He was doing a few of these sort of somersaults and all that sort of stuff. But he was very, very cocky, very full of himself. And he made it registered in my mind. I sort of thought, yeah, this is a young kid worth keeping an eye on. And my goodness, wasn't his prediction accurate?
Ian, do you have anything that predates that?
Absolutely not. No. The first I can recall of him is when he started appearing on undercards. I'd heard one or two stories that they had this flashy guy, this cocky young kid in the gym who did somersaults and all kinds of other things. I saw him on an undercard somewhere. I mean, he obviously grabbed your attention. He flounced into the ring, somersaulted over the ring ropes, and he was bouncing around in there. And you thought, God, he's irritating, frankly. I mean, Roy Francis, remember Roy Francis reffing him? He beat somebody, knocked them out, and started doing a lewd gesture over the guy's prostrate body on the floor. And Roy Francis really read the riot act to him in really unceremonious fashion, told him, don't ever try anything like that again anytime you're in a British boxing ring. I mean, you've taught him a lesson, I think, but, you know.
I remember that one, Ian.
Yeah.
I think it was at the Grosvenor House Hotel, and he was in about his third or fourth fight, and he did this. And was it Miguel Matthews? And I remember Roy absolutely tore into him. Yeah. I think we're talking among sort of boxing people here, so we can say how it was. And he said, "You do that again, and I'll throw you over the fucking rope." It was as graphic as that. He absolutely tore into him, because you know what Roy was like. He was old school, wasn't he? And he just wouldn't stand for it.
Mm. It's interesting, though, because there was always something, I think, with Naz where he straight away upset the boxing establishment. I remember having rows with Steve Bunce about it, and he said, oh, it's just you're the old crowd. You know, he generates heat and electricity. He's exciting. You know, you don't really get it. He's Generation X, all that kind of thing. I suppose there was a kind of a truth in that, because, you know, the young crowd, I think, really switched on to him. He made a connection to a different kind of audience. Maybe not an audience we wanted. Maybe not stuff that we really appreciated when you saw it in the ring, because he was just too irritating. I mean, I thought he was an irritating little twerp, to be honest. Back then, he obviously could fight. He could really fight, but he did get on our nerves. But you know, when I looked around the arena, you saw him and you saw the crowd, and they loved him. Most of them absolutely loved the show that he put on.
So let me ask you this. I don't mind necessarily who answers, but, you know, obviously Chris Eubank Sr.'s persona was was well grafted and well managed, and he sort of knew that he was the man that people loved to hate. Do you think Naz wanted to be someone that people loved to hate, or do you think he just wanted to be himself, or do you think his character was just the actual Nassim Hamed just cranked up?
I think in the early days it was just him having a load of fun, and when he went to Frank Warren, I mean he had a fight or two with Barry Hearn, didn't he, and then with Mickey Duff. But when he went to Frank Warren, I mean Frank could tell you himself that he thought he was absolutely a breath of fresh air, and I think he saw something in him, and I think he saw that star quality and that ability to connect with a crowd and a young crowd that maybe the other two didn't see. And I don't know what you reckon.
I don't know if it was ever that orchestrated with him. I think he just was who he was. I remember having a conversation with him and asking him in an interview once, do you think a lot of people buy tickets to see you get beaten? You know, this was when he'd become more established and he'd become a major star. And he was absolutely horrified by the idea. He said, absolutely, you know, in that Yorkshire accent, he said, absolutely, no way, I don't know what you're talking about, Curly. I mean, he used to call me Curly. Do you remember that? trying to get at me, and he did manage to get at me as well doing that, by the way. I think he just, I mean, he's no doubt there were people, older people in the audience who did want to see him put on the seat of his pants. But no, I don't think it was like Chris Eubank at all. Where that was always part of the whole sales pitch with him, really. I mean, Barry Hearn knew it as well, that, you know, they don't care why they fill the arena, do they? If you sell the tickets for any old reason, it's good news, isn't it, in boxing? But no, I don't think the Naz thing was just that clever. He was who he was. I mean, you said, John, right at the beginning, you know, you saw him when he was 13 years old. He was like that then.
Yeah, he was. And he, you talk about him alienating older fans. And, you know, I mean, he alienated some of the older media people, didn't he? I remember Hugh McElvanny, rest his soul. You know, Hugh hated him. He really disliked him massively. And yeah. I think, what do you remember when we went over to America to those big fights and when he eventually fought Marco Antonio Barrera and lost? There were a lot of people, a significant number of people in the media who were very pleased to see him finally get his comeuppance.
Yeah, absolutely. But I'll tell you something, and we should, I think, establish this early on. Whatever we thought about some of his antics and the way he carried on and his kind of feisty relationship, as you've said, John, with the media, I think we all quickly realised he was a heck of a fighter. It wasn't all just show. I mean, when I first saw him, I thought, well, he's hanging his chin out to dry a bit. Somebody's going to, you know, hit him on the button. But his reflexes were fantastic. He was quick across the ring. I mean, and could he punch? I mean, you know, I looked at his record last night before we did this, you know, 36 wins, 31 by knockout, and just that one defeat by Marco Antonio Barrera. I mean, he's a proper fighter. I think, you know, he's right up there. He's in the top 15, probably, fighters at any weight that we've ever produced. And, you know, he did it on both sides of the Atlantic, made a mint. So he was, you know, we used to have jokes about it. he'd come up to you and say, don't forget, I'm a great fighter. Well, he was a great fighter, wasn't he?
Hey, John, so obviously, you mentioned about being on those undercards. Do you have any early recollections of early interviews that you did with him or any one-to-one time that you had with him early doors, Ian?
Well, only insofar as he was just supremely, supremely self-confident. He always had an astonishing belief in his own ability. And back in those days, particularly when he was with Brendan Ingle, he not only had that confidence, but he had the ability and the coaching to absolutely deliver. I think the first really big one I remember was when he was at the Ponds Forge in Sheffield, and he fought a guy called Bel Castro and won the European Super Bantamweight Championship, I think. And it was on late at night. And I think, as memory serves me, I think they'd virtually given it to ITV free, but it got a big, big audience and it attracted attention. And from there, from there he was away. You know, I mean, Reg Guttridge, bless him. You know, he was when he was flicking over the ropes, he'd say the ego's landed, didn't he? And that sort of thing. He was absolutely a gift to television, particularly. I mean, I knew him in those days through radio, and yeah, he was fun. But I mean, in television terms, he was just such an exciting figure to watch. And he was one of those early figures who absolutely transcended the sport. He brought boxing to an altogether wider audience.
Yeah, he did. I used to hate doing the interviews with him. In those days, the commentator, and I was working on Sky Sports, I had to do the interview with him at ringside after the fight. And it went out, a lot of it, to the crowd as well. So you're always at a disadvantage, aren't you, with that? Because the fans are adoring of the boxer. You can't ask him any very pointed questions because they're all going to groan or boo you. So it's not like a proper journalistic editorial interview. So I remember asking him one time and saying, you seemed a little bit sort of slow to get into your rhythm tonight. And there were boos, of course, from people in the crowd. And he just said, Curly, you're just trying to make your name on the back of mine. our interviews were a bit quite interesting along those lines. But you're right, John. His confidence was through the roof, absolutely through the roof, until, and I think this is important, when he went to America and fought in that barnstormer with Kevin Kelly at Madison Square Garden. I think that night he was put in touch with his own possible vulnerability for the first time. I think he sat there after that fight when they'd both been on the floor. I think it was three times apiece. He won it, but he sort of realized for the first time, you know what? I can get hurt and I can get beaten in this game. And I don't think he'd ever really thought that before.
That became part of his marketability, I think, didn't it? You know, because he was vulnerable and he could get chinned. I think that was one of the reasons that people wanted to watch, because it was hit or be hit. And that,
yeah,
that
was quick enough to do it, though, John, in the early days, were they? No one looked like, I think, Alicia, was it Daniel Alicia who kind of put him down? And it was all a bit of a shock and we all gasped. Nobody ever looked really quick enough to get their feet in position to land the kind of punches that might finish him off. But, you know, that day, that night at Madison Square Garden, and what a night that was, against Kelly, was extraordinary, really. And for him, it broke brilliantly, because HBO, of course, they were paying out the big money in America, absolutely loved that. And so did the American audience. Who's this flashy kid, this cocky kid from England? He's come here and he's in this fantastic fight. I mean, it was great TV, wasn't it? Even if it was cash and go for Hamid. So that launched him in America. I don't think his American campaign went very well at all. It didn't. But I tell you what, he didn't have to make some money. I think he was worth at the end something like about, you know, $30 million, maybe more.
So that Kevin Kelly fight that you mentioned there, obviously that was the night of the magic carpet, right?
Yes. Yeah. There were a few different ring entrances. I mean, do you remember the one? I think it was one where he tried to reenact Michael Jackson's Thriller video.
They got
a bit too carried away with the ring entrances. I mean, you know, you think of the Barrera fight. They spent more time planning the ring entrance than the fight.
Yeah, of course.
Hey, and I wasn't too taken with the graveyard that he came in when he fought Wayne McCulloch.
That's a good story, John, because I was at the meeting with the Americans, because we used to go to the HBO production meeting, and so it was Halloween, wasn't it?
Yes.
Remember? So that's where they came up with the idea that he's coming through the gravestone, and I said at the, I never usually spoke because it was their meeting, but you know, we were there as the doing the British. And I said, don't you think that's a little bit risky? I said, you know, because people do die in the ring. I said, him coming in through gravestones, what's the PR after the fight going to be if somebody gets, you know, badly hurt or worse here? And the American guys just said, oh, it's just a bit of fun. And on the meeting went. So, I mean, I thought it was extremely suspect. Certainly for us old stuffy old Brits, anyway.
I remember, Triz, when we went over in, what was it, December 1997, was it, when he fought Kelly? I mean, we went over there and there was this huge, huge electric sign in the middle of Times Square. And I remember being with Naz and he's looking up at the picture of himself in Times Square. And I think he was just blown away by it. I think he thought, I've made it.
Yeah. He flew over on Concorde for that fight as well. And I remember Kevin Kelly saying before the fight, because he played his part in it all as well. And he said, I'm going to smoke your boots. So it was there was a lot of hype and it was all good. I think it was freezing cold. I remember doing stuff out on the, out on 7th Avenue outside Madison Square Garden, standing with Glenn McCrory in absolutely freezing cold. You were probably in the background making silly signs at us, John, as you used to do when we did those pieces to camera, trying to put you off. Remember that? you succeeded a couple of times.
That Kevin Kelly fight, gents. Obviously, you talked about how brash and confident Naz was in the early days. Do you think he felt the pressure at all with that, with the American audience cracking America? I know he's talking about the Beatles and, you know, the pressure and Brits going over there and struggling in the past and stuff. Or was he just loving every minute out there?
I think he loved it, but I think you're absolutely right, Tris. He did really feel the pressure. I think he knew the big money was down. He was expected to perform. He'd been the king this side of the Atlantic. I think where it really got to him, though, you know, and we should talk about this for a bit, was around that Wayne McCulloch fight, because that was around the time of the split with Brendan Ingle. A very sad split, really, when you think of everything they'd done and everything Brendan had done to make him who he was and the money earner that he was. When he arrived in America for that fight, he was very, very stressed. I think he got into Atlantic City late for the fight. He demanded to take over Marco Antonio Barrera's training slot at the gym. That didn't go down very well at all. And then he had the famous confrontation with all the media guys, notably Colin Hart, of course, he was a doyen of the Sun. He called him Colin Fart, turned his chair around to face him, and then told a guy from the Mirror asked something, and he said, "Yeah, stop asking me questions that I've already been asked 1,000 times." And then he looked at Colin as well and said, "I don't like you, Colin Fart." And so, and Colin said to him, "Well, I don't care for you much either, but we got to work together. So can you just answer the question?" So on it went like that. And he had clashes with everybody that week in Atlantic City. And of course, in the fight, he stank the place out. So, you know, you talked about the pressure of being in America. You know, that fight was a PR calamity. And John will confirm that. You probably had some kind of run in with him yourself, didn't you, John? We all did.
I did. Yeah, absolutely. I did. I was on the boardwalk, just minding my own business one day, and he comes up to me. It was in Atlantic City, that fight, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And he came up to me and started, you know, eyeball to eyeball, having a real go. And what do you do? He's a fighter. I'm a journalist. I just stood my ground. And afterwards, I remember one of his brothers saying, "Hey, you weren't afraid, were you?" And I said, "Well, I quite wish he'd chinned me, because if he had done, I'd never have had to have worked again. That would have been the end of my professional career, because I'd have just sued his arse off. And that would have been the end of that." But yeah, I mean,
he never have got up though, John.
He was absolutely out of control over there, wasn't he? I mean, he was off the scale. And the PR disaster is an understatement. I mean, he created a lot of ill feeling.
Yeah,
well, he rounded on Adam Smith at Sky Sports, didn't he? He rounded on Adam, right?
Oh, big time.
Yeah. I mean, and Adam was very close to the camp as well. I mean, he virtually lived, you know, when Naz was big, he was up there all the time doing pieces with them. So he had a real in, but yeah, he turned on him too. But here's an interesting story. You remember his dad, you know, the family were from, you know, the parents were from Yemen, weren't they? And they had the shop in Sheffield. His dad witnessed some of it, and told him off and said, you can't talk to, he said, to call me Mr. Dark. He said, you can't talk to Mr. Dark and Mr. Smith like that. So about a couple of months later, we got this weird invitation, Adam and me, to go to the Dorchester Hotel in London, where he'd be waiting for us. And sure enough, he was dressed in a very smart, you know, white jumper that he just bought very, very expensively. And he sat down and he actually said to us, look, I want to say sorry for everything that went on in Atlantic City. And he said, I was under a lot of pressure and stress at the time. I'm sorry if I upset you guys. You know, I realize I was a bit of a prat. I mean, it might not have been his exact word, but, you know, I walked away from that and thought, do you know what? Hats off. I said to you, like, okay, fair enough. But so, you know, I think, and that had all come, I think, from his dear old dad telling him that he had to start conducting himself a little bit better. I mean, he didn't ever really change, but that was a handsome gesture. So there was another side to it. And I'll go back to it again. Whatever happened, he really was a very, very good fighter, though. I don't think America ever saw really, other than that Kevin Kelly night, the very best of him.
Yeah. So, John, I mean, I wanted to speak to you both, actually. But, John, you can kick us off about his relationship with Brendan, not necessarily the split. And I know we're around that sort of era where, you know, everything's starting to go wrong with McCulloch and stuff. But was what Ian mentioned there about Naz and the influence of his father, was he, how much of a paternal role model was Brendan to Naz?
I think very much so. I think, I mean, Brendan, any fighter who'd been through that gym would say that Brendan was very much more than just a boxing trainer. He was almost like a social worker to a lot of those young kids who came, some of them who came from pretty dysfunctional backgrounds, and Brendan kept them together. And I think Brendan was almost like a second father to Naz. And in those early days, he was hugely influential. And the style which he'd honed with Harold Graham was the one which he used with Naz to such wonderful effect. And I think his wisdom and his coaching produced who, for me, I mean, Ian said top 15. I think I'd put him a bit higher than that. At his best, Naz was right up there. And I think had he not split with Brendan, had he kept doing what he was doing, because later in his career, I think he cheated a bit on his training. But had he stayed with Brendan, I think he would have gone down as one of Britain's all-time greats. And he was, you know, to a significant extent, I think Naz was kind of Brendan's masterpiece. And that's what hurt Brendan so deeply when they split up.
Yeah, I can't really add to anything John said there. I mean, yeah, it was a... I think he was like that really with all the boxers in his gym, wasn't he? His father and son. He was a one-off, Brendan. And you're right, he was like a social worker as well. Some of those kids, you wondered where would they have ended up in life if they hadn't wandered into that gym in Winkerbank, Sheffield. And he made stars of some of them. Even the guy he renamed Slugger O'Toole. I can't remember what his first name was. Of course,
Del Castro Smith.
Look at Johnny. Johnny... I think, you know, he lost, didn't he, early on in his, you know, when he was a hopeless amateur, and he turned him into a world champion who made some good money and, you know, has gone on to carve out a wonderful television career. You know, Ryan Rhodes, you can go on. I mean, and Harold, of course, who, you know, is probably, you know, he's right up there, isn't he? If you have an argument about who were the best British boxers never to win a world title, Harold would be somewhere near the top of that list. I mean, he could, despite the fact Tony Simpson called him a glorified limbo dancer, he was great too. So, I mean, you had to admire everything that happened in that gym. And I do think it's sad. But the trouble is, you see, when you're being paid a percentage of relatively small money, it all works okay. But when it becomes millions and you've got to pay that percentage, you know, I think that's where the trouble started to arise, and where the split started to occur. And, you know, maybe Naz thought he'd outgrown it all. You know, he went on, he made his 30 million or whatever it was. But yeah, that's sad. It's not the first time it's happened, of course, in careers, is it? You know, you can think of
It's Ricky always a shame. It's always a shame when you lose those romantic links. So a bit like Kevin Rooney and Mike Tyson, isn't it? You know, they sort of have this, you know, they evoke a very strong sense of nostalgia. Something that also evokes a very strong sense of something, I'm not sure if it's nostalgia or what, it was the night Naz became king against Steve Robinson.
Yeah, yeah. That was an amazing night. What a night. I mean, it was pouring with rain, Cardiff Arms Park, and you might remember, I mean, it was kind of seen, you know, Robinson had become an unexpected champion and done really well, hadn't he? And, you know, he was like the pride of Wales. And I remember the whole crowd, when Hamed came in the ring, chanting as one, Hamed, Hamed, who the fuck is Hamed? Hamed, Hamed, who the fuck is Hamed? This went on for about 5 minutes. I mean, this was a lion's den. I mean, there wasn't going to be ever much doubt that, you know, Hamed was going to win the title there against Robinson.
Because it was one of those where you had to apologise to your audience if you're hearing something that offends you. You're so sorry.
Well, we're on a podcast, so if you're listening to the boxing podcast, sorry, everybody. Leave out if you don't like it, everybody.
The atmosphere, though, was incredibly intimidating. You know, when you look back at that fight, I mean, Naz was absolutely brilliant that night. I think there's an argument to say he was never better than the night he beat Steve Robinson, because he just won every aspect of the fight, did an absolute number on him in front of one of the most just one-sided crowds, if you like, that I've ever known. Because they were to become a hero down there. And they were there, as Ian said, they were there to see Naz get beaten. They really, really wanted to see their man do him. And Naz that night, sensational, wasn't he, Ian?
He was sensational. I mean, the punch that finished it, that left hook, it was my worst ever commentary, by the way, that night, because just at the key moment, somebody got up in front of me. I never saw that punch until later. So it wasn't a great commentary on Sky Sports.
It was one of those, oh, he's down. He's down.
So it's almost what you don't say. Thank God there's a replay that comes up quite quickly on my monitor. But, you know, that happens sometimes. But that's another story of the problems you have as a commentator at ringside. But that's what happened that night. But yeah, you're right. It was a scintillating display. There was some row, wasn't there, about how he was kind of manoeuvred into position to get that chance. Tris might know more about that. He never really fought at the weight any much before that.
Well, that's right. And I think it was all quite short notice as well, where Steve Robinson was sort of called back off a holiday to come and fill the slot.
Yeah. Yeah. Frank Warren, he wanted Prince Nassim Hamed, who had such marquee value in that world title slot. So, yeah, well, a promoter is a promoter, and he's, you know, Frank knows his job.
I mean, that atmosphere was a pretty toxic atmosphere, but Naz seemed to thrive in it, not just as a fighter, but he was loving every minute, wasn't he? He loved being the villain of the piece that night, didn't he?
Yeah, it reminded me a little bit. Do you remember when Chris Eubank went to Germany and fought Ralph Robignani, and the whole crowd were baying for blood there as well? And Eubank just stood on the ring apron doing that tapping of the gloves routine, just staring out at them. And by the end of the night, he'd put on a pretty sensational performance and won, Eubank, and he'd won over all the German fans as well. So yeah, it takes an awful lot of bravura, doesn't it, to do that in the face of a crowd that hostile to you?
They're showmen, aren't they? And I think they thrive off it. I don't think Eubank was ever better than when he beat Rikidjiani over there. I think that was arguably as a fighter, I think that was probably his best night. And I think there's a very good argument that Naz was never better than when he beat Steve Robinson.
Ian, was that when you became a believer, the Steve Robinson night?
No, I think I was a believer before that. It's obvious. We all watch a lot of fights, and you can see quite quickly if somebody's got a special talent. And I think we knew he had a special talent, which is why he was an overwhelming favourite to beat Steve Robinson that night. So, I think we knew there that he was going to be around for a while at the top of that featherweight division, and it would take somebody a little bit good to beat him.
Yeah, and then you know, through this time or through the early days, was there a charm offensive from Naz with the press and the media, or was he always hit and miss?
No, I don't think so. I can't remember it if there was. Was there, John?
No, there was never a charm offensive. It was just, you know, sort of, here it is, take it, you know, love it or loathe it, this is me and I'm the best. And yeah, if you talk to Naz now, he's still like that. He's still sort of, you know, and he's cocksure. And that's how he was. But, you know, after he beat Steve Robinson, there were a row of fighters who he just demolished. And that extraordinary, not only his reactions and everything, but that extraordinary power. If you look at Naz as a fighter when he was in his prime, I mean, he'd got footballer legs, hadn't he? He might have only been 5'4" or whatever he was, but he just generated such extraordinary power. And he was a strong guy. He had terrific strength in his legs, and a lot of his power, I think, was generated through that.
Yeah, remember how he used to call that? He'd hold up his gloves to you, his hands, and say, "These are my rocket launchers." He'd say that almost every press conference. But I mean, he became so big that I think it was Jose Badillo he fought in Sheffield. I mean, topping a bill, and on the undercard was Joe Calzaghe against Chris Eubank. I mean, so yeah, that's how big he was, and filling out arenas. Yeah, I mean, it was quite a ride he took us on. He really okay. was. You said what he's like now. That's interesting, because about a couple of years ago, I went into my cafe in my local village where I live, and I heard a voice. I ordered my coffee, and I heard a voice behind me go, "What are you doing here, Mr. Dark?" And it was Naz. He was sitting having a coffee, and he said he brought his kid over to the village where I live to play tennis. So the boy was 12. So he was supposed to go and see his boy play tennis. But I got talking to him in the coffee shop, and he was there for an hour talking to me in the coffee. Of course, he's never going to see featherweight again. But he was quite interesting, and he was much more mellow back then. But the interesting thing was, at the end, the kid had finished his tennis and came in with his mum to the shop. And I said, I said to him, "Are you going to be a boxer like your dad?" I said, "Are you going to?" And he goes, "I'll be better than him." The apple doesn't fall far from the tree, does it?
John, have you seen Naz at all lately, or in post retirement?
I've only really seen Naz when he's turned up at fights on the occasional commentary stint. And as Ian said, I mean, he is a big lad now, isn't he? He really is.
He's 48, I think he is.
Say again.
He's 48 now. I have to believe.
Yeah, something like that.
And Ian, let me. Well, in fact,
he's what's in time, isn't he? When you see him now, it's as though you're not seeing the same person, because you remember him how he was, and he's one of those people always locked in time, who kind of, because I think partly because he retired so young, he is almost forever young.
I think he retired. I think he was 28, wasn't he, when he retired? Yeah. He did have a lot of problem with his hands, didn't he? I mean, like most punchers.
He had one fight, didn't he, after Barrera. Didn't take the rematch, which he could have done, and fought a guy called Calvo, who nobody had ever really heard of, and he stunk the place out. And I remember being at that fight, and he was booed. The crowd were jeering him. I think that was a hard thing for his ego to take. And, you know, you're talking as well at that time. It's in the post 9/11 era, and the whole concept of selling an Arab superstar in the United States became a very, very difficult thing to do. And I think possibly the offers ran out.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the Barrera fight was, it sort of was like a full stop on his career, really. He had that fight with Manuel Calvo afterwards, but it was obvious that it was kind of the end of the story. Booed. But, you know, we should talk about that Barrera fight, because everything went wrong for him, didn't it, really, that night? I remember talking to people in the camp, And they said, well, you know, Naz is going to knock him out. Naz is going to knock him out. And I said, Barrera's only been stopped once, I think, by, was it Poison Junior Jones? Yeah. I said, how, you know, what's the plan to win the fight if it goes the distance? It could well go the distance. You're in with a modern great here. And I never really got an answer to that. And I started to wonder about, you know, what the prep for the fight was. And then you started hearing about all the paraphernalia, about what color gloves they were going to wear, what the ring entrance was going to be like. I thought their focus isn't there. And Barrera had trained like a demon for that fight. And I remember Barrera, I got to know a couple of people in his camp, and we got invited to have sushi with him. Was it the MGM the fight was in? I can't remember one of those. Yeah. So we had sushi with Barrera's camp, and they've sold us a sort of crazy line about how they were going to come out and blow Naz away. So that obviously wasn't the tactics, and we kind of knew that the reason we'd been invited there was for a bit of spin from Barrera's camp. But they did it in an extremely charming way, and the sushi was very nice.
Naz by that stage, He was having to lose so much weight to get down to featherweight, wasn't he? I mean, he was training more, you got the impression, more to make the weight than to win the fight. I think the tactics had been, he believed his own hype, as you say, that he was such a big puncher. And I don't think then that he was properly prepared to fight Marco Antonio Barrera. I think they really did just think that he'd just go out there and blow him away. And, you know, Barrera, as we all know now, with the benefits of hindsight, he absolutely did a number, didn't he? Who's your daddy now?
Do you think Emmanuel Stewart had much control over Naz?
No, probably not. No, I don't. I think Manny went.
Brendan, was it really? In the corner, I think.
Sorry, go again, Ian.
I think it was never quite the same after Brendan, was it really? In the corner, I think Manny Stewart was brought in, but it was very late in his career by then. I think he had that fight, do you remember, in Detroit with Manny in the corner with Cesar Soto, and that was another very turgid affair.
Yeah, that was not one of his finer nights, was it? And I think that was known for one thing.
That was known for the body slam, wasn't it? The Soto fight.
That's right. Yeah, picked him up and hurled him down.
Yeah, and then he broke his hand against Augie Sanchez in Connecticut, didn't he? So as we were saying, the American adventure, though it made a lot of money, it wasn't vintage Naz. Vintage Naz was earlier in his career, the Robinson night, and then some of the performances he put up in defense of the title later.
Tom Johnson, what a night, what a performance that was.
Yeah.
That's what took him apart, didn't he?
Yeah. Blew away Billy Hardy in that grudge fight in a few seconds, didn't he?
There was a real desire for him to be matched with the likes of Barrera, wasn't there? Do you remember there was conversation about him fighting Mayweather? And I think they crossed paths once in Big Bear, but also there was a lot of pressure, I think, from the American side for him to fight Marquez as well.
Yeah, there was. Those fights never came to be. Of course, it often ends up that way in the careers of professional boxers that we talk about these fights. I wonder whether it would be the same, you know, AJ, Tyson Fury, you know, are we ever going to see that? Has it all gone, really? Has it gone up in smoke? So it took forever. We never got Lennox Lewis and Riddick Bowe, did we? So there'll always be fights you wanted to see and never did. But it'll always haunt Naz a little bit, I think, that he fought a modern great like Marco Antonio Barrera, and clearly the prep hadn't been right.
Yeah, so John, obviously Ian mentioned there that behind the scenes there were whisperings that things were going wrong and so forth. Do you think Naz still thought he had enough with his so-called rocket launchers to get over the line and beat Barrera?
I think like all fighters, they kind of begin to almost believe their own hype, don't they? Yeah. And I think Naz was no different in that. I think he had just smashed so many, and I think that he believed that he was physically the bigger man, that Barrera wasn't really a proper featherweight. and that he'd have the power to take it away. But as we know about the actual fight, Pereira didn't go on the front foot. He fought as a counterpuncher, and Naz, who himself was principally a counterpuncher, found it very, very difficult to solve that problem. And Pereira racked up the rounds and in the end won, despite the fact that he had a point deducted for marching Hamed into that corner post in the last round, was it? And despite that, having a point deducted, he still won by a fairly wide unanimous points decision.
Ian, watching that fight, were you of the opinion that, you know, it's only going to take Naz one punch to turn it around? Or did you just think it was getting further and further away from him?
I thought the longer it went, the less likely that was going to happen in the fight. It became pretty apparent that he was getting outboxed and outthought in there by Pereira from quite an early stage. And he didn't just look as sharp as we'd seen him in the past. And yeah, I kept saying, I think, you know, he's got the equalizer. We know he's one of the great punchers in featherweight history, that he might be able to just pull this round with one punch. But did we really believe it? No, I don't think so. And, you know, when Pereira did that, it kind of symbolized the whole night when he shoved his head into the ring post and said, "Who's your daddy?" So, you know, that was Pereira saying, "I'm the boss here. I've made the statement." And
I think in the run-up to the fight, Ian, I mean, a lot of us, I can remember us having the, you know, the conversation over dinner when we were over there in Vegas. And I think a lot of us really did think that Naz was in for a very difficult night over there, because if he couldn't see the evidence that he'd not prepared properly, I think we probably did see it. And we knew that Pereira was going to be a real handful, because, you know, having seen him fight the likes of Morales and watching him over the years, he was pretty special as Marco Antonio Pereira.
Oh yeah, he really was, wasn't he? I mean, those fights with Morales, they're right up there in the best I ever saw, especially the first one. I was absolutely tingling when I finished commentating on that. Wow, it was just from beginning to end brilliant.
Yeah, and disregarding and overlooking and underestimating somebody like that.
Yeah.
It wasn't really terribly smart, was it?
No, but that's maybe where it'd get to. As you said, and you maybe do get to a point where you almost become like a parody of yourself, and maybe he'd stop putting in the hard work that had always been necessary, probably that Brendan made sure he always did put in. Because you get older, don't you, too? You can't do what you did when you were 22. When you get a little bit later on in the career, you can't cut the corners quite as easily.
I mean, Morales and Naz would have been a great fight as well. But let me ask you this. In terms of your dealings with them, both of you have had co-coms, whether it was radio or TV. And we've talked about Naz's sort of antipathy towards the press and the media. When you were, say, flanked with a Glenn McCrory or a Jim Watt, was he different then, Ian, at all?
No, not really.
Because we heard the stories, obviously, of like Mike Tyson pulling out Glenn McCrory and thinking that, you know, they had that mutual respect. But yeah. But Naz didn't kind of have that for fellow fighters any more than anybody else.
He probably didn't know what Glenn McCrory had ever done in the ring either, if I'm honest with you. You know, they didn't know that Glenn had been a world cruiserweight champion or that Jim was world lightweight champion. Probably not. He probably knew they were ex-fighters. Let me tell you one story. I remember we flew over to a fight and he'd been listening. Naz had listened to our commentary of Ryan Rhodes, his big mate from the Sheffield gym. Was it Otis Grant? I think he fought. Yeah. And Ryan put in a good display that night, but it wasn't enough. You know, Grant knew a bit too much and won it. We got wind when we got him to America that Naz was furious with us, you know, and Glenn especially. He'd had a huge go at Glenn saying, "You shouldn't be doing that. You shouldn't say the other guy's winning and that he's better. And, you know, you've let Ryan down." So Glenn said, "Did you actually see the fight?" He said, "No, I just listened to it." Said, "So you haven't seen it and you're having this big go publicly at us." So no, he didn't. I don't think he had any special relationship with or link with ex-fighters. He probably does now. It'd be interesting to talk to him now, wouldn't it, about the whole period in his life, you know, the time of his life I'd love to do that. I had that chat, as I say, he was more mellow. I had that chat in that cafe, the unlikely chat in the cafe.
I bet he wouldn't be quite as mellow with a camera or a microphone in front of him, you know, because he goes back to the performance then, doesn't he? I don't think he's quite as reflective maybe when you put a microphone in front of him as when you put a cup of coffee in front of him.
Very
so
well.
that Barrera fight, I mean, for many people that defined his career. And obviously, John, you sort of said about the high points from Robinson onwards. It's a bit harsh, really, to say that, oh, when he hit the top level, he was found out, isn't it?
Yeah, but you judge great fighters, which is what he described himself as. Judge them by at the highest level, don't you? And great fighters are made out of great fights as well. And when he had the biggest test, he didn't deliver. And you look back, yes, he was a fantastic fighter, Naz, absolutely there. And I'm very much an admirer of Naz as a fighter. But I look back at his whole career and look at him as being away from the sport at 28. And you sort of think, well, yeah, he was brilliant, but did he really deliver? Did he really do what he might have done? And I think you have to say maybe no, because had he absolutely had that belief and that desire to prove himself as an all-time great, he had the rematch clause. He could have taken Barrera again, gone back to the drawing board, worked it out, and found a way maybe to reverse the result. That could have happened. And I'd have liked to have seen him go in there again with him. But of course, it never happened. So it's still, when you talk about Naz, a little bit of a case of what might have been rather than what was. And I don't think he didn't really quite deliver.
Yeah,
did he?
But I think, you know, he'll go down as the greatest featherweight of the modern era from these shores, won't he? No question about that. Should we be that hard on him that he didn't beat Barrera on that night when the preparation and the focus clearly wasn't there? But I do think that's a fair criticism of yours, John, that, you know, he could have stuck around, he could have gone back to the drawing board and tried to rediscover that fire and desire and had those fights with the likes of Morales, you know, Marquez, that kind of thing. But, you know, that didn't happen. So that will be a little cloud hanging over the career. But, you know, if you measure a career and say, but professional boxers, if they can go out being healthy and wealthy and have made a bit of a splash, that's a pretty great career. And he's done that, hasn't he? He did that.
Yeah. And I suppose it's interesting when you talk about the money. And Ian, you've obviously mentioned that figure, 30 million quid, which I've seen before as well, is obviously Hagler would say it's hard to get out of bed when you're wearing silk pajamas, right? So, John, yeah. Do you think there was a matter of him losing the hunger and desire and really feeling like he had nothing left to prove at the end?
Yeah, I think that's probably a very accurate assessment. You know, he almost had this rock star life, didn't he? He'd got everything he could possibly want. You know, anything he wanted, he could buy. He could buy the flash sports cars. He could buy a mansion if he chose. And he's got enough money to last him for the rest of his life. So from that perspective, yeah, he massively achieved and got what he wanted out of boxing. But I'm just being a little bit hard, but it's just that there's a little bit in me about that wants to see the great fighters have the great fights. And then we can see them together and see who really was the best. I mean, that was one of the great things about the Hagler, Leonard, Hearns, Duran era, that they all fought each other. So at the end of it, we could say, yeah, well, I think he was the best. And you can actually point to the fights. Whereas Naz only had the one real career-defining fight. He could have had more.
Yeah, and when you look at the guys that Barrera went on to fight, obviously Barrera, Morales, Pacquiao, Marquez, and obviously they've all sort of defined each other, and Naz is just another good name on Barrera's record. Ian, how about this? I mean, you've obviously covered the careers of Ricky Hatton and Frank Bruno as well, and these were beloved English, British fighters. Where is Naz in that in that ranking now? Like, do people love him, or do people loathe him, or, you know, where do you think the public sentiment is with Naz now?
I think some love him, some loathe him. Depends maybe on your age. But he did have, you know, and this is a great thing, I think, for any fighter to achieve, that crossover appeal. You could go up to probably to 100 people in the street when he was in his peak time, and people would know who he was. Didn't matter whether you were into boxing even. You knew about this Prince Nassim Hamed guy. So he made an impression on people. Maybe not always a favorable impression. So he had that. No, not as popular as Ricky Hatton, not as popular as Frank Bruno, but he was somebody that had a kind of magnetism. I mean, Steve Bunce, we used to have the odd row about it. He was right. He did have that heat, that electricity. When he walked to the ring, there was that feeling that something maybe quite interesting was about to happen.
John, did you always have good access to Naz through the years?
Yeah, he was usually pretty good in that way. I mean, some fighters get increasingly difficult when they achieve fame, as I'm sure Ian would agree. You know, I mean, some start getting the big fights and begin to get a bit of an opinion of their own worth and don't really want to speak to the media anymore. But I think Naz was always pretty decent like that, and I think apart from that one time over in Atlantic City, I think he was sufficiently shrewd to realize that the media represent the fans, and if you don't talk to the media, you don't talk to the fans. Remember, this is before the internet, this is before social media, so the way to speak to the fans had to be through the radio microphone or the television.
Yeah, I mean, most boxers are great. I mean, the access in boxing is fantastic compared to, say, football or one or two other sports. The fighters want to talk, don't they, in the meantime? They've got tickets to sell for a start, so it's almost in their contract that they do the publicity. Yeah, I don't think it was any of a problem with him saying, no, I'm not going to do interviews with you. I mean, you mentioned some fighters clamming up. It's not many, but I remember a guy called Roy Gums who fought Mark Kaler in a pretty good fight at Alexandra Palace. Before the fight, he did this very bad-tempered interview, press conference with us, and started moaning, goes, nobody knows who I am. No, you know, you never write about me. You're always writing about Mark Cayley. You never write about me. You know, none of you journalists, you're all here now because I'm fighting Mark Cayley. Said, no, I never get any recognition. So afterwards, I said, do an interview for us for BBC Radio. He said, no, I'm not doing any interviews. So he'd been moaning the whole thing. So I said, maybe that's why people aren't writing about you, because you've got a bit of a chip on your shoulder about doing this stuff anyway. But I think Naz, I wouldn't fire any arrows at him on that front. He was, the camp was pretty open.
Hey, and obviously, yeah, sorry, John, go on.
I always thought he was pretty good, and particularly back in the days when he was with Frank Warren and with Brendan Ingle, particularly in those days, it was such a good story to tell and to sell. He was great fun. You know, you look back and we've talked about some of the bad times and some of the difficult times, but he was a lot of fun to be around.
Yeah. I mean, it's a privilege and a pleasure to cover most fighters. I've got to be honest and say there were times when it all wasn't always a privilege and a pleasure to cover Naz, even though we knew he was a very, very good fighter. Sometimes there were difficult moments. Some of my interviews with him at ringside, I thought there's a bit of point scoring going on here. And I think, you know, Colin Hart and people like that would probably say the same thing. So it's a funny, it's all a bit mixed up, the emotions with Naz. But one thing's for certain, he was a great fighter and made a lot of money doing it.
And let me ask you this. So obviously you touched upon him damaging his hand in the Augie Sanchez fight, but he inflicted far worse damage on Augie Sanchez, who was hospitalized and never fought again. That was only two fights away. After that, there was only Barrera and the Calvo fight. I seem to remember that Naz was maybe haunted to an extent by what he'd done to Augie Sanchez. Maybe the game was up then. Do you think there's any truth in that? John, start with you.
Could be an element of that because, you know, fighters are sensitive people, aren't they? I think if you talk to Chris Eubank, he would certainly say that he was never the same fighter, the same man after the Michael Watson fight. And other fights as well. Yeah, Barry McGuigan, he was always haunted by what he was capable of doing. And I've never had that conversation with Naz, so I don't know what his inner feelings are about it. But I certainly wouldn't be surprised because I know that for all their bravado and their macho strength and capabilities, fighters are sometimes very, very sensitive human beings.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, Barry was always haunted by that young Ali fight, wasn't he? Earlier on his career, Barry McGuigan, and as you say, Chris Eubank, never quite the same again. Yeah, I think it is possible. He'd got older by then. He'd been around a long time, and the Jorge Sanchez thing, we've never spoken to him about it, but maybe that did just turn down the light a bit and switch off a little bit of the desire. It's only speculation, but it's a valid thought.
We mentioned Eubank near the top. Were either of you around when? Was it Naz and Eubank had a set to in the airport once?
I wasn't there, but I heard about it. And
they had a
firm and frank exchange of views, I think we can say.
Why waste it at the airport? Think how many... Well, I don't know what weight they'd have fought at. Or maybe, I don't know, maybe these days.
But they were great days, weren't they? I mean, when you talk about, you know, when you talk about Eubank, Ben, Lennox, Naz was right up there with, you know, leading the charge with those guys, wasn't he?
Yeah. I mean, the fact that here we are, what is it? It's getting for 20 years on or so. You know, we're talking about him now and there's a lot to talk about. So that says something, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think
certainly
so.
Does. Certainly does. He is one of the big characters of British boxing. And as we said earlier on, like him or loathe him, you certainly certainly noticed him. And he capitalized wonderfully as a result of it.
So, Ian, let me ask you this, and then I'll ask you for some final thoughts. Ian, so, I mean, John had touched upon this earlier. He was obviously a world champ. He's one of the best we've produced. You said top 15 that this country's produced. He is in the International Boxing Hall of Fame, which is the sort of rubber stamping of greatness. Did he fulfill his potential?
Probably not all of it because, you know, there was that big landmark fight with Barrera, which he lost his only defeat in 37 fights. But yeah, he didn't fight Morales or Marquez and those kind of people. So maybe not all of the potential, no. But in many other respects, he was a massive success, a huge personality, crossover appeal, made a fortune doing it. So I wouldn't want to really criticize him big time over not going on from that Barrera defeat or not coming back from it.
John, is there anyone you've interviewed or covered through your career in any sport that is anything like Naz at all?
That's a big question. I've come across a few who are pretty cocksure and full of their own belief in their own abilities, but I don't think any of them really outranked Naz in that respect. You know, you talk to a prime Mike Tyson. Yeah, he knew what he could do, but it was a different sort of charisma that he had. You know, he was an intimidating and fairly frightening man when he was in his prime. Naz was never frightening. And when you look back at his career and his personality, I think it's a mistake not to be kind and not to be generous. He did an awful lot, and I consider myself lucky to have had a microphone in my hand and been at ringside talking to him, talking about him, and commentating on his fights. It was a great experience.
Yeah, I think that's something, obviously, I think that's an important thing to touch upon. And Ian, you said that earlier, really. But he inspired a lot of young kids coming up, you know, a lot of kids. And obviously, we can see that with the Winko Bank gym, with the likes of Kid Galahad and so forth, even still today. And I think that's probably a side that's well worth touching upon, because while some of the older established people might not have taken a shine to him, the people coming through beneath him really did, didn't they? People really looked up to him, and he showed what doors could be open for a little kid from Sheffield to be on the bright lights in Vegas and New York.
Yeah, as John said, it was a great story, you know, coming from the corner shop in Sheffield, wandering into the gym, just having an extraordinary talent and doing everything he did and becoming one of the great fighters of his era. So it's a cracking story. And yeah, people would have watched him. You wouldn't want everybody to copy that style, would you? You've got to have fantastic reflexes and you've got to have that power to be a new Naz. So in a way, he kind of like, well, Harold Graham did it before him and one or two others. He kind of ripped up the textbook on how you were supposed to go about conducting yourself in a boxing match with a high-held hands and all that kind of thing. So the style was a one-off, really, in many ways.
And John, I mean, just in closing, I did want to get a little bit more about Brendan in there. How much do you think Brendan was hurt by the Naz departure?
I think he was very, very much hurt. When Brendan died, the significant person who was not there at the funeral, and I gather it wasn't down to Naz's decision, it was because he was quietly told, please don't come. The one person not at Brendan's funeral was Nazim Hamed. And I think Brendan was deeply hurt. He always was ready to talk about it, and he was pretty damning about the way Naz's career went when he was no longer involved. And as I said earlier, I think there's a good argument that Naz was Brendan's masterpiece in his wonderful training career, the greatest fighter he produced, and the one who exemplified everything that he believed in as a boxing trainer, was Nazim Hamed. And when Naz walked away, I think it hurt Brendan very deeply.
I think Naz's career was like a firework, wasn't it? It shot off, you know, with all this great expectation. And then there was an almighty bang with Robinson. And then we got the displays against the likes of Ingle, McCulloch, and, you know, Kevin Kelly, all those big names. And then it sort of quietly fizzled. And that was that.
That's how it works, too.
Yeah, and I think it, you know, there were moments of greatness, and it was just, you know, for me, I think those last two fights against Barrera and Calvo leave a slightly sour taste and a bit of a false economy, because obviously he wasn't defined by that, and people in this country remember a very different Naz to, I think, the ones that the people in the US do.
It's maybe like political careers, Tris. You know, there's always an unhappy ending.
Yeah, so, I think so.
Listen, so on. But,
I think the beauty of Naz, though, is as you alluded to earlier, is he completed boxing, really, to get out with your faculties intact, money in the bank, and to be able to have the financial freedom and independence to do as you wish. We've seen so many fighters over the years lose so much, give so much, and not wind up with a fraction of what he has. I think he's one of the very few who's completed boxing and done it on his terms.
Yeah, I think, you know, how many boxers ended up with a big mansion beside Wentworth Golf Course? You know, it's an unlikely setting for Prince Nassim Hamed. You know, I think there were times when he really thought he was royalty.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. But gents, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk about the highs and lows of Nassim Hamed, and I look forward to reconvening for a future podcast in the near future.
Yeah, great, Tris. Great, John. Yeah, it's good to do the ringside rewind, hey?
Good to revel in some great memories, and boxing certainly created many of those.
Brilliant, gents. Well, we'll be back soon.